What can we do about climate change? Does anybody have any solutions? Well, actually, Guy Dauncey does. He's the author of Stormy Weather, 101 Solutions to Global Climate Change. We're going to hear a speech from him, given November the 25th, 2006, for the Van City 60th Anniversary event.
Our next presenter also has an impressive background. Mr. Guy Dauncey is a speaker, an author, a sustainable communities consultant who works to develop a positive vision of a sustainable future and to translate that vision into action. He's author of the award-winning book, Stormy Weather, 101 Solutions to Global Climate Change. His next book, Cancer, 101 Solutions to a Preventable Epidemic, will be published in the spring of next year. He is president of BC Sustainable Energy Association, co-chair of Prevent Cancer Now, founder of the Solutions Project, co-founder of the Victoria Car Share Cooperative, and editor of Echo News, a monthly newsletter that promotes the vision of a sustainable Vancouver Island. I was reminded this past week that Guy played a role in the evolving Van City story. I was reminded that back in the early 1990s, he was invited to the board table to sit down with the board and the executive to help us try to figure out what role a financial institution could play in the important community issues of the day, particularly the environmental issues. He helped us develop a strategy and move forward on that strategy. And as a result of some of his work, Van City was one of the first financial institutions to sign on to the series principles. So it gives me a great deal of pleasure to recognize that contribution that Guy made to Van City and the communities that we're in, and to welcome him here tonight.
Thank you. Well, good evening, and it's a real honor to be part of a Van City event, which is one of the handful of two or three single most progressive financial institutions in the world. So my presentation tonight is a counterpoint to Bill Rees's, and there's a lot of the stuff here, so I wouldn't try to remember all this stuff or follow it all. Basically, we're talking about a climate crisis, and we've got to remember that in Chinese, the word crisis means danger and opportunity at the same time. It's one mindset. The dangers are clear. The warnings are coming in every week from all over the place. But so is the opportunity, and I'll come to the big picture of what this is all about. It's a journey in 200 slides. You don't want to think about that. I'm going through the origins of climate change, the impacts, the solutions, and the action. If you try to remember all this, your brains will explode. Do not blame me. I gave you warning, right? How did it all start? It's a long story, because it starts with the Big Bang. The whole universe is made of energy. Every single thing is made of energy. But we are, the core of the problem is we're just beginners in learning how to use it. We are very, very ignorant in understanding this whole thing. And our denial that Bill talked about is part of that ignorance, that we don't want to know, we're sort of stuck in the past and stuff like that. But we're also very dynamic, we're changing, we're moving fast. It took us millions of years to work out how to make fire. Then there was a big discovery, oh look, we can make fire. The fire would last a long time. We didn't think again until that started to run out. But during that time and long before, the sun had been shining down on planet Earth, generating fossil fuels through stored hydrocarbons, stored ancient sunlight by these huge trees that fell underground. Over the millions of years, by heat and pressure, they turned into coal. Coal is stored ancient sunlight, stored hydrocarbons. And the same thing happens under the oceans, making oil and gas. So long before humans have even evolved, we're not even, you know, being primates. The fossil fuels have been laid down. They're waiting there ready for us, if we want them. Around 1200, when the firewood started out, we discovered coal. We didn't know what the coal was. It was just this black stuff, and it burnt, so we used it. And then 1858, we started discovering oil. Really, Darwin had only written The Origin of the Species a couple of years before. So we had no understanding of deep time or of how ancient the Earth was. The natural gas is only 1890s. Then we just started damming the big rivers. Once we fell in love with power, we thought, well, let's dam the rivers as well. Then we sort of became really clever, we'll make nuclear power, and whoops. Then we go, oh my goodness, there's a few problems here. Back in the 1960s, when the tar sands were just a dream in someone's eye, the engineers were planning to do one nuclear explosion every 2 days underground in the tar sands to free up the tar sands. Let's put a good peaceful use of nuclear bombs was what they thought. Because we are falling in love with our own smartness, and we have no concept of the depth of our ecological ignorance. That's the core problem that Bill was addressing. Our cleverness and smartness is way ahead of our ecological understandings. But never mind, we get lots of power. We can run SUVs, we can run gadgets, we can travel to Hawaii, we can do all this stuff because we got power. But remember, we're just beginners with all this power. We don't understand how it affects our planet's ecology. This is what the Earth looks like at night right now. Of that lighting, 85% comes from burning those fossil fuels that were stored by nature millions of years ago. Here's North America, same story. Here's the whole planet. If you look at Japan on the far right-hand side, see the tail of Japan, that chunk there next to it is South Korea, and the black hole north to it is North Korea. That's what development does. So, meanwhile, our Earth's got this very thin atmosphere which traps and holds the sun's heat, which again we only really recently discovered, and it's trapping CO2, water vapor, methane, and some other gases. They're all, any molecule with more than two atoms will trap heat. So here's the temperature of if you track back with the ice cores from the Arctic, and you go back, 400,000 years, now we can go back 650,000 years and longer, as Bill says, and we see that the temperature is in sync with the CO2. When they have very low temperature during the ice ages, the CO2 levels are very high. When it's warm, the CO2 levels are warm. These two are, it's difficult to chase out the cause and effect, but they're very tightly linked together. As we burn those fossil fuels now in the aeroplanes, in our cars, they accumulate in the atmosphere. And there are other fossil fuels, as well as the CO2, this is hard to see, but we got up there, methane gas, the F gases, PFCs, SF6, CFCs, nitrous oxide, they all trap heat. And in the answer to one question, it's 72% of the problems from burning fossil fuels, 12% from deforestation, 16% from those other chemical gases, what's called the F gases. So this is the curve that Bill showed us with the increasing CO2 in the atmosphere. Went from a steady 280 parts per million. Today it's 380 parts per million. And here's where it's heading. Completely unknown territory. We've never, ever had CO2 levels this high before. This is like we are really outside the bounds of our experience or knowledge or anything at all. And this pushes up temperature. The two goes together. As the greenhouse gases accumulate, the temperature rises. This melts the Arctic. As Bill went through, we're looking towards the total meltdown of the summer Arctic ice by 2050 and of the winter Arctic ice entirely by 2100. You'll be able to take a kayak from Nunavut across to Siberia and go through the North Pole without seeing ice in 100 years' time at the present trends. And the ice is melting in Greenland much more rapidly. There's enough ice in Greenland to melt sea levels by 7 meters, just in case you are planning a nice, cottage by the sea. And this is what's happening, where the ice on top of Greenland is melting, going down under Greenland and causing it to lubricate from below, allowing it to slip into the ocean. Glaciers all around the world are melting from the same reasons. The Antarctic ice sheet is also breaking up. There's another 6 meter sea level rise locked up in the West Antarctic ice sheet. And New Scientist in March of this year said, if we were to burn all the world's fossil fuels, we're looking at that's a 12 to 13 degrees Celsius rise in temperature. So it's completely unthinkable. James Hansen, the top climate change scientist from NASA, says that the last time the world was 3 degrees warmer, which is where we're heading at the moment, sea levels were 25 meters higher. That's what we can look forward to if we don't act soon. And then just a week, 2 weeks ago, John Holdren, the new incoming president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, said, if the current pace of change continues, the catastrophic sea level rise of 4 meters this century is within the realm of possibility, much higher than previous forecasts. The CO2 is also accumulating in the oceans, as Bill said, which are becoming more acidic and making it much harder for marine life to exist in the oceans. And this has not had anything like the media attention that the rest has. When it comes to the science, we need to be really clear on this. When a sampling of peer-reviewed articles was done in the Science, which mentioned the words climate change, 100% of them agreed with the basic philosophy that humans are responsible for the majority of climate change. Not a single one expressed doubt. But when a survey was done of articles in the media, 53% expressed doubt as to the causes of climate change. You and I don't read the scientific journals, we read the newspaper. This is the New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, etc. The media journalists have done us an enormous disservice by misleading us and confusing us and making us believe there's not a problem, we're not clear, so we can't act yet, and ending up with situations where our federal prime minister does not seem to believe that climate change is a problem caused by humans, and our BC Minister of Energy, Richard Neufeld, apparently believes the same thing. Fundamental, very deep problem for us. ExxonMobil spent $19 million deliberately fostering this confusionism, making us believe that it's not certain, it's not... same as the tobacco industry did. Oh, no. You can go on smoking, don't worry. Deliberate confusionism to get us not doing anything to stop their flow of profits. Meanwhile, we've got rising ocean temperatures, increasing density of hurricanes. We've got things like this happening in New Orleans. We've got insurance losses rising. We've got oil and gas installations at sea level ending up in the wrong place. This was not designed to be there by the planners. And this is what a 6-meter sea level looks like here in Vancouver. Now, I'm not good enough to spot this building on that map, but I think we're on an island. There goes the airport, there goes the ferry, there goes Swanson, there goes the I-5 down to America, heading our way, unless we do something drastic. We're talking millions of refugees. We freaked out when we got 50 Chinese boat people off the west coast of Vancouver Island. We're talking 8 million refugees, Bangladesh, 100 million refugees when you take in the whole of the Chinese Shanghai Peninsula, Delta rather. Where are they going to go? Which country is going to take them? And at the current predicted temperature rises, we're talking of 25% of all animals and plants that are land-based becoming extinct within now 44 years. Very dire warnings. Our forests are burning, the temperature are disrupting ecosystems. There's the mountain pine beetle doing devastating damage in the interior of British Columbia. As we see the melting snowpack, we've got problems with our hydro reservoirs because of, you know, if the snowpack melts early, it doesn't run into the reservoir in late summer. This year, finally, the media got on board. Time magazine came out very strongly. Al Gore's film came out. How many of you have seen Al Gore's film? Show of hands. Yeah, it's a fabulously well-done film, which has got totally right on with the science. And there's a second problem, which is peak oil. It's an identical set of solutions to that, but it's another problem. This graph shows that we've discovered less new oil every year since 1961. But we're using more oil every year. So these things don't add up. This is the curve of depletion. The black curve is there, is the tar sands. It's just nowhere near enough. It doesn't solve the problem. We're going to finish using this oil and gas anyway. It's going to be gone. What do we tell our children and grandchildren if we just blew it all on destroying the earth? And this gives us rising gas prices. There's no escaping it. Get used to it. And stop complaining at all this stuff, you know, because they're paying twice the price we pay now in Europe. And all the cars are running, the whole economy is operating, and no one complains. They just get on with it. Because we are so addicted to oil and gas that we'll pay whatever it takes. In recognition of the coming crisis, I named this ship Titan Uranus. You enjoy that one? Hey, this is not photoshopped. That's the real thing. The age of fossil fuels is very short. Now, get this in historical perspective. That is the age of fossil fuels. If you're a teacher, 1,000 years from now, you will be teaching classes on the age of fossil fuels, how it lasted 200 years, and then it was all gone. And I believe you will teach how humans overcame that change. This is a natural human transition. Every planet in the universe that has laid down fossil fuels, the human equivalents will go through this kind of crisis. Because when we're sort of ignorant and young, we grab the fossil fuels and think, what's fun? We can use these things, and then, oops, they've all gone, and we get smart. Okay, part three, what do we do? Do we drink and be merry as the waters rise? Do we go off and eat another planet somewhere else? Or do we sit down and solve the problem using our intelligence? We're talking about the next great energy revolution, which also applies to farming and to forestry, because those are the other two components of climate change. Here's the big picture. We move from the age of firewood into the age of coal, into the age of oil and gas, a little bit of no-show from nuclear until they finally gave up and went away, into a permanent age of sustainable energy from solar, wind, hydro, biofuels, and enormous sustainability lifestyle changes to go with that. Because we're indulging. We're like the addicts going for the extra hit all the time, and we're not coming out better for it. We've got asthma, we've got loneliness in the suburbs, we've got isolation, we've got car accidents. Life in the future solar sustainable age will be far happier, healthier, greener, more beautiful, deeper, more wonderful. It's a beautiful future we can get if we just get over this hump. Our goal must be to reduce our greenhouse gases by 100%, and I believe we need to do that by 2025. I think the urgency of this has not been registered yet. Every year the feedback factors get stronger. That's the goal we need to take on. If we apply the same mentality we did during the Second World War, when for 2 years it was illegal to drive a car in North America because all the fuel had to go to the tanks and airplanes, we can do this. But we just have to generate the willpower. Farming is causing 8%. Fossil fuel, 72%. As I said, that's the data before. The industrial F-gases, 14%. Just legislate them out of existence. Simple as that. Set a date and they're gone. This is what Denmark has done. Denmark, for some of the F-gases, says they've got to be gone by 2010. Well, guess who gets to invent the new ones? They put a patent on them. They sell them back to the rest of the world. All we're asking is the application of human intelligence to eliminate the F-gases. Farming is a big problem here. A cow is producing more CO2 equivalent than a car. When you count the oil used to make it, the methane the cows produce, the nitrous oxide from its fertilizer. So eating meat is a very big part of climate change. I can be self-righteous here because I've been vegetarian for 30 years, but I can't be self-righteous because I've not been vegan. I still use dairy and cheese, so I'm partially responsible for all this. But eating meat is a big part of the problem. Deforestation is another part of the problem. Here we have to consume less wood, consume less meat because of the hamburgers and the soy farms happening where you're cutting the rainforest down to make meat, and change our forest practices so that all forestry is certified. It's off the page there, but never mind. The fundamental problem is the fossil fuels. Every car, every plane, every house, every coal-fired power plant pumping the CO2 emissions into the air. Next time you fill up your tank, watch the meter go past as it goes, 10 liters, 11 liters, 12 liters. Every liter is going to be 2.5 kilograms of CO2 into the air. 13 liters, 14 liters, 15 liters. Every liter you put out, another CO2, another 2.5 kilograms. Overall solution is sustainable use of sustainable energy, as well as the forestry and the agricultural changes. Sustainable energy is anything produced from a natural source that's inexhaustible and self-regenerating. I shan't go through the list. We'll come to it. First of all, heat. Can we keep warm without using oil and gas, using sustainable energy? You can have that very same radiator using totally sustainable energy, as I'll show you. First, every house can be twice as efficient with today's technology. And furthermore, you can get low-interest loans from Van City to help you do it under the Bright Lights program. I was not paid to say that. I don't need to be. But, you can go to, right now, all of us can take on the responsibility to make sure our homes are as tight and efficient as they can be. You can install solar hot water systems on your roof. And, when the Best Western Inn in Kelowna install solar hot water for their customers, their customer hot water bill fell from 52 cents each per day to 26 cents per day overnight. 50% reduction in their heating load by shifting to solar hot water. This is the Best Western Inn with the on the roof up there. And, Greg Saloom's one of our solar champions in BC. In China, they're way ahead of the game. They've got 35 million homes with solar systems on the roof. All those little square things you see on the roofs, solar hot water systems, all using the evacuated tube technology. We're so far behind the game in BC that we don't realize the train left the station a long time ago. We're in comfort land and gaga land when we think we're comfortable. We're missing the boat here. If you want to do it yourself, shower. Take an old garden hose, wrap it around a tree, and you can have a shower out in the garden. Because the heat of the sun is giving us 3,000 times more energy than we use on the entire planet every day, all the time. We're just not using it. Our project within the BC Sustainable Energy Association called Solar BC has now set a new we've got a new goal of 100,000 solar roofs by 2025. And we see this happening by mandatory legislation. Every new house must have solar roof installed. Every time you sell a house, you must have a solar hot water system installed on the roof. That's the logical way to go. Every council can pass that. And yes, you can clap because we've got to get behind this and tell our councillors about this sort of stuff. We need visionary, positive approaches. Air source heat pumps, lower mainland, very effective ways of heating, taking air, heat from the ambient air around us. Ground source heating, wherever you have a house on the land, you can take the energy from underneath it and use it to heat your home through the geothermal process of heat exchange. Wherever you're on water, on a lake, on a river, on the sea, you can use the heat in the ocean because it's warmer than absolute zero. Brentwood College in Mill Bay uses heat from the Saanich Inlet to heat its arts faculty. When you or I would die from hypothermia within 5 minutes, but there's enough heat there to heat the building. You can mix solar thermal heat with ground with geothermal or geoexchange underneath the building to put more hot water to recharge the heat under the building so that you can bring it back in the winter. You can take heat from the sewers. This is how we're going to heat the athletes' village in southeast Falls Creek for the Olympic Games. When because this heat in sewage, apply those little pipes at the bottom and it'll extract the heat through a heat exchange process. We can retrofit all of our major sewer pipes in every city with heat exchange technology and use it to put back into the buildings to keep ourselves heated instead of using oil and gas. You can have solar walls that attract the heat and radiate through the building. This is a house in Sweden that uses solar hot water systems 12 months a year. And this is a project in Okotoks, Alberta, doing just the same. Where on the garages at the bottom, where it says solar community panels, they're generating 7-10 times more solar hot water than they need. They're locking it away underground in an insulated area of the ground and bringing it back in the winter to heat the homes in Alberta, minus 20, throughout the winter. And once this installed, this technology will last 100, 200 years. You can use biomass cogeneration to take old tree trimmings and waste wood and gasify it and use it to heat the whole project. This is in London, Bedzed, a Beddington Zero Energy Development, where the cars are on electric vehicles on solar energy, total heat exchange process, and, you know, it's zero energy. They generate all their own heating and their own power. And this is the project that Vancity is deeply involved in financing in Victoria called Dockside Green. The whole project's to be carbon neutral, zero energy, following the very best principles, every building LEED Platinum. And it's an absolute credit to Vancity that they're in board financing one of the best real estate developments in the world. Yes. Okay, next question. How do we travel when the magic carpet of oil no longer works? So I do a game in my mind. Let's take 100 imaginary trips. How do we get that down to zero use of oil? Well, we just stay home for 5% of the trips. We didn't need to travel in the first place. We can walk for 5% of the trips. For heaven's sake, we've got legs. Our legs walked us around the entire planet when we left Africa. We'd never have got to North America if we had to depend on oil to get here. And, you know, it's atrocious that the most dangerous time at school is 3 o'clock in the afternoon and all the mummies and daddies are driving their SUVs there to make sure their kids are safe from other SUVs. I mean, hello? Get those legs working. We know that in the suburbs, the children are more obese and more at danger of being killed in car accidents than city kids downtown who walk more and get more exercise. This is a battle against obesity as well as climate change. It's stomach warming problems. Okay. We can cycle 15% of the trips. Let's imagine every city with cycle routes that are safe, that are off-road, where you've not got a mirror that's three miles wide coming from a basic SUV knocking you off. Imagine that, yes, this some buildings, one very close to us right here, doesn't have any bicycle racks for cyclists. Those who count, you know, there's nowhere to tie your bike up. There are schools with no cycling racks for bicycles. It's atrocious competing with cars on the aggressive Vancouver streets. I'm from Victoria, and I look at Vancouver, I go, whoa, mommy, what do I do? It's not safe here. Safe cycling should be everyone's right. And if you feel that you can't, you know, manage the muscle power, go electric. Put a little electric battery on your bike. That's myself in Rome, bottom left. $500 in Rome you can buy an electric bicycle for. You can buy one for $1,000 out here, and they'll cost you 0.1 cents per kilometer is the cost of having an electric bicycle. Plug it into the grid because our electric power is so cheap. And I'll see more of that coming up soon. You can rideshare 5% of the trips. Right now you can go to carpool.ca and arrange carpooling. But you can also do it with among your friends and neighbors. Set up a website, get all your friends on the same page. And when you're going somewhere, click in and say, I'm going to Victoria for the weekend. Anyone coming with me? Share rides. When I came in this morning off the ferry, when we slipped into the HOV lane because there was all of two of us in the car, all the other cars had one passenger only, stuck in massive traffic jams, burning emissions all the time. So rideshare, be neighborly. And then we get transit. This could be 20% of the trips. In Boulder, Colorado, the whole city has brought in a U-Pass system where, and if a neighborhood votes to be on the U-Pass or the EcoPass system, they get, their transit pass costs $50 to $130 a year, and it's paid for on the municipal taxes. So effectively, it's free. We can all do that. The UPass project that Vancity has helped get going up at UBC is an excellent way to move, where the UBC students voted to pay a little bit of their fees to cover their transit for the whole year, then everyone's on the transit system. In Colorado, they rethought their transit system. they had a big community process, and they said, we want smaller buses, we want them more mobile, we want them, you know, more than a 5 or 10 minute walk, we want no more than a 5 or 10 minute wait, and furthermore, the drivers can choose the onboard CD music they play. $50 a year, folks. This is very doable stuff. In Curitiba, they've gone one further. This is a town in Brazil where you load through that big cylinder thing. So you go up the load up a ramp, you pay your ticket, then you load on the horizontal level. Anyone's tried getting into a bus with a pushchair and a second toddler, and you've got again, it's a total pain. It's just not designed in a family-friendly way. So we learned to learn from the Brazilians. So far, we've got a 50% reduction in the fuel we need without having to look at a single vehicle change. So now we're going to look at vehicles. So here's the choice. The world is debating whether we're going to go hydrogen or biofuel or electric. Big debate. If you look at hydrogen, you've got to get the hydrogen from something. There's hydrogen in this water, but the bond that ties the H and the O together is very tight. So we use natural gas. Well, hello. Natural gas is CH4. C stands for carbon, so it still produces carbon dioxide emissions. And then the natural gas in North Bay is going to run out. We've got to ship it in as liquid natural gas. And guess where it comes from? It comes from those wonderful stable democracies, Iran and Russia. They have the gas. And then it's all going to run out anyway. But just by the time we get going for the hydrogen, the global supply runs out. And we're left with nothing. This does not make sense. Okay, the green hydrogen. We use wind energy or solar. We split water. We put it in a fuel, make hydrogen, put it in a fuel cell, make electricity. Well, hello. We've just used electricity to make electricity and lost 30% of the energy in the transition. So this is like, again, a dodgy proposition. And you've got to have an entire infrastructure to pipe the hydrogen all over North America. Okay, let's look at biofuels. Ethanol. The problem with ethanol, if you use land to grow crops, is that the land required for one SUV fill-up could feed someone anywhere in the world, actually, for a whole year. That's the reality of ethanol. And there's also, with the federal government proposal to have a 5% ethanol formula, you've got to use oil to get the ethanol, to drive the tractors, to put the fertilizers in, to sort of do all that stuff. And it's a very marginal greenhouse gas gain because you're pumping out greenhouse gases to get the ethanol in the first place. So I just don't think this works. And the current, with ethanol right now, we're basically talking the world's 800 million auto owners in conflict for food with the world's poorest 2 billion people. We're going to be stealing food out of their mouths by putting it in the tanks of our cars. In Iowa right now, potentially 100% of the grain harvest could be going to the ethanol places to manufacture fuel for cars. It just doesn't seem right, especially because of what's coming up. This biodiesel from a soybean co-product, which is not quite so bad. It's still growing the crop, but it's a byproduct and not actually the product itself. And there's biodiesel from waste fats that's available right now from every restaurant where it's sitting doing nothing. But there's not much of it. I'm sure there's people in this room using biodiesel right now, but it might cover the bus fleet, but it's not going to go much further. You could also get biofuels from recycling organic waste. In Halifax, they collect all their organic waste. In Zurich, they're doing the same thing, and they've got 1,200 cars running around on compo gas, you know, just really by using anaerobic digestion. So we could be doing that, but it's a small number of cars in a city the size of Zurich. Or is the future the electric car? This is a concept car that's had like 35 designers and one technician working on it. But hey, design is where it's at. If we look at a real smart electric car, this is the joy of it. It's going to cost you $7 a month to operate. Even if you're doing 10,000 miles a year, 16,000 kilometers, because electricity is such an incredibly efficient form of motivation. You can buy these vehicles right now in Vancouver. But they're limited to the speed limit, but in Vancouver, that's fine for a lot of trips. If you're really wealthy, you can get the Tesla Roadster, 0 to 60 in 4 seconds. It'll go 250 miles per charge. Even this is costing you $8 a month to run, if you can afford to buy it. But their goal is to make profits on this and then produce a regular family vehicle. But if you take a regular hybrid vehicle, such as the Prius, and add extra batteries, you get a plug-in hybrid electric vehicle. It's got the fuel you needed, but it's also an electric vehicle for all local uses. And if it's flex fuel, this is the ultimate vehicle in many ways. You can also, if you want, put a hydrogen device inside the engine that will make onboard hydrogen and fuel, put it straight in the combustion chamber and reduce your liquid fuel need by 22%. And then you've got the solar electric car. Take your electric car, plug it into the sun, and off you go. That's my intention. As soon as I can get a cheap electric car, put the solar panel on the roof and drive off the sunshine. This is, you know, the future of transport. And the lighter the car, the less power it needs. So if you can make your car really lightweight, your running cost is down to $2 or $3 a month for a car that'll take two people like that. And then there's car sharing. So instead of owning a car, you join the cooperative auto network here in Vancouver, and then you take out the car for what you need. And most vehicles are small. You don't need a big vehicle, so you can take the very small, efficient ones to get around. Trucks can also have the hybrid technology that'll reduce their fuel needs. But all this assumes the use of electricity. So where's it going to come from? If our future is electric, where do we get that power? And furthermore, if all of BC's drivers and truckers bought electric vehicles, how much electricity would they need? The answer is that they need around 8,000 gigawatt hours a year. Our current electricity use is 60,000. So it's very much within the range of the doable. Even if I'm wrong by a factor of two in my maths, it's within the range of doable technology here. Can we generate enough of this power to do this thing? First of all, we start off with everything being twice as efficient, the huge potential for using less energy. We could use 50% less energy if we really got smart with our light bulbs, our fridges, our cookers, our homes, everything we use. We should be banning the sale of incandescent light bulbs in Canada by 2010. They shouldn't be on sale at all. We should not be allowing the sale of inefficient fridges. They should be banned, as California did 30 years ago. That's how far behind we are. LED light bulbs are coming on range now. You can buy them in IKEA. 1 to 5 watts. Regular big light bulbs, 100 watts. The compact fluorescent is 20 watts. This is the future of lighting. Wind energy, huge global potential. 40 times more than today's power needs from wind around the world. And there's now proposals coming up for floating offshore wind turbines that can even withstand hurricanes. And the global wind installation is really ratcheting it up enormously. There was a report came out just this week from Europe, from Greenpeace, that said if we're at 60 gigawatts today, which is 60,000 megawatts, we could be looking at 1,200 gigawatts by 2030. And I think we could go a lot faster than that. Here in North America, in Canada, we could get 40% of all our electricity from wind in northern Quebec if we chose to. And in America, North Dakota could produce a third of the entire U.S. electric needs, and the farmers could carry on farming underneath, as they are currently getting on with it. In Idaho, in Montana, in Dakotas, the farmers are getting on the game. They can make income from wind while carrying on farming. There's a rooftop turbine arriving on the market in Britain. It's expensive right now, but that circle around the blades eliminates the noise because it's the friction at the tip of the blade that makes the noise. This is a silent turbine. And they're saying 12% of the world's electricity by 2020. This is an image from Denmark to show how farming integrates with wind energy. Solar energy, another on enormous growth curve, 40% growth per annum, costing around 50 cents a kilowatt hour right now, huge global potential. And as the price falls, the production increases. It was $100 a watt, then it's right down to 4 or 5. When it hits $2 a watt, every single house could install it. And we then have bylaws. We should have the bylaws right now saying every new house must be built with a 2-kilowatt solar system on the roof. So you can generate energy and feed it back into the grid when you have more than you want in the summer. It should be a bylaw and mandatory for all housing. And every time you sell a house, you have to retrofit it with solar voltaics first. This is what the future looks like with solar shingles direct on the roof. You don't need to have the big aluminum frames around them. This is an integrated solar wall in Freiburg, which is the capital of solar energy in Germany. If you're doing a big fancy architectural building, you're paying a budget for marble to prove you're self-important anyway. You can use that budget for solar cladding to put solar energy on the building instead. 10% in Nevada, if you colored it with solar electricity, enough energy for 100% of U.S. electricity needs. Not suggesting we do that, but that's the mathematics of this. 5% if the U.S. was twice as efficient. 5% of Manitoba could produce 100% of Canada's electricity needs, or 2.5%. Now, this would, of course, meet objections from the United Mosquitoes Association and maybe a few other Manitobans. Not suggesting we do it, but that's the level of technology. We can also get power from microhydro, from geothermal energy under the ground, from tidal energy, which is basically lunar energy, especially in BC, where the tides are going back and forward, pulled by gravitation, from waves happening already off Scotland, off Portugal, from biomass power, potentially using, you know, agricultural and forest wastes, as long as you're within close range for trucking to a biomass plant. Otherwise, you're using more fuel to power the truck, and the whole energy equation falls apart. Farms can gather energy from the cattle and their pigs, and then there's nuclear power. Think about nuclear power to understand, just so as to eliminate it forever. Private sector won't touch it. Only government money will work on nuclear power. If you're going to use government money, if you put it into energy efficiency, you'll get 2 to 10 times more energy. The waste is radioactive for 1 million years. It's a limited resource, can be used to make an atomic bomb. And furthermore, this summer in France, the French, who have a lot of their power from nuclear, had to close down some of their nuclear power plants because they couldn't cool them anymore because the rivers were too hot because of global warming. So the very time when you want your nuclear power, you've got to close them down because it's too warm. Like, duh, this does totally not make sense. It's a no-brainer. Forget about it altogether. It's only the nuclear industry investors who want nuclear power to happen. Tie these things together, you get the distributed grid in a complex, real-time, interactive, digital arrangement. So all this stuff flows well. There's energy storage systems, there's energy distribution systems, there's time-of-use metering, so you pay much more at peak times, etc. And all the prices are falling. Because this stuff's technology-based, all these prices are falling as we go into the future. This is the good news for the economy. Globally, in 2004, we used for all our energy purposes 120,000 terawatt-hours. If the whole world was twice sufficient, that's 60,000 terawatt hours. When you add up potentials, tidal, biomass, geothermal, wind, etc., it comes to almost 1 million terawatt hours. That's 8 times more than we need, plus all the solar, because that's not included in the mathematics. And that's just tapping the beginning of the solar energy potential. There are now projects to generate solar thermal energy in the deserts of North Africa and ship it by high-density underground cables across to Europe. Here in BC, we analyzed our power production, and we said, if we're using mostly BC Hydro figures, if we look at the potential for wind, etc., there's an additional 84,000 gigawatt hours available to us over a 30-year period, generating 400,000 jobs. This is really good news for the economy. You've got to retrofit every single house. We already have the technologies we need to enjoy life in a green, peaceful world. What we lack is the vision and the policies and the political will, that choice to do it. As Bill was saying, we've got to come out of denial and choose to do this. Sweden has, as a nation, adopted a vision to hand over to the next generation a society in which all major environmental problems have been solved. We could do that in BC. We can do that in Canada. Why should we as a generation be dumping this stuff on our children and saying, you solve the problem. I'm happy in my SUV. I want to carry on flying to Hawaii. Sweden also plans to end its dependency on oil by 2020 as a national goal for the whole country. You just plan it, you do it. This is very straightforward stuff. In parts of Europe, they've got a fabulous policy called the Advanced Renewables Tariff, which guarantees that people producing solar, wind energy have access to the grid, are paid the price they need, the price is secure for 20 years, and this is now a policy that's been adopted in Ontario as well. If you put solar in the grid in Ontario, 42 cents a kilowatt hour. Put wind in, 11 cents a kilowatt hour. And in Germany, it's led to 110,000 photovoltaic systems, 2,000 biomass plants, 16,000 wind turbines. By far the best successful policy in the world. We're trying to get that established in BC. We run up against resistance from the fossil fuel lobby and ministers who don't believe in climate change and people who just don't think this stuff matters. We also need carbon taxes. We could eliminate income tax if we add carbon taxes and pollution taxes. Tax credits for all the stuff we buy. Stop subsidizing fossil fuels, etc. Incentives for organic farming. A goal that the whole of BC has 100% organic farming by 2025. And you put a tax on the chemicals and the pesticides and you put all the income into organic farming subsidies. Every time we switched to a new generation of energy, it's associated with economic progress, not with chamber commerce type defeatism. There's ocean shipping. This is a wind-powered oil tanker, for the fun of it. You're supposed to laugh there, folks. This is a company that's actually gathering investment. This is a proposal for a Scandinavian. I don't believe we'll ever use ships like this. I think it's a nonsense to plan trading at this level. We should have local economies. But anyway, they're planning to do a ship that'll go around the world, powered by the suns, the waves, and the wind. What about flying? Well, I don't have an answer here. This is an airplane from Europe designed for hydrogen, but that whole area above the fuselage is solid hydrogen. And there are 23,000 flights every day. Where's the hydrogen come from? It just doesn't add up. You can fly by the sun. Good thing. Okay. This will take one passenger, and it's got a few problems. You cannot join the Mile High Club in this plane. You need 30 layers of thermal underwear for male reasons for that particular club, right? You can maybe do... You missed that joke. Maybe the men got it. You can maybe fly these Zeppelins, slow transport possibly, but nothing big. I think we're going to have giant plasma screens in our city squares where you can go and meet your girlfriend and you can touch fingertips and kiss, but you can't actually wrap your arms around her. And we're going to have to stop long-distance romance because all long-distance romance is premised on cheap fossil fuels. We've got to build local economies and fall in love with local people. Because local people, local kisses don't need fossil fuels. Long-distance kisses need a lot of fossil fuels. We've got to build local, we've got to grow local organic agriculture. It's nonsense to ship crappy strawberries up from California that taste like dead cardboard. If the whole world moved to organic cultivation, look at this. In the developed world, we get 20% lower yield, but that's only 20% loss of water in the food, not of nutrients. In the developing world, a tiny 3% higher yield. Overall, over 4,000 calories per person per day on the entire planet. And we only need 2,000 a day to be healthy. We get more food, more nutrition, more health by shifting the entire planet to organic. And furthermore, we also defend ourselves against cancer because organic food contains something called salvestrols. Any of you who've got any involvement with cancer, just note down this website, salvestrolscience.com, salvestrols.ca, because there's a huge breakthrough as the organic food protects you against cancer because when organic food is attacked by pests or fungus, they generate a natural defense system called salvestrols, which defends us against cancer. When you spray the plants with pesticides, which come from oil and gas, the plants never attack by fungus, so they never get the immune system within the plant. They protect us. Everything we consume uses lots of energy. We've got to celebrate unconsuming. We've got to celebrate living more simply. We've got to see the giant consumers as the ultra drug addicts of our age and scorn them and shame them for being so greedy in their consumption. We've got to celebrate simplicity. So, action. What do we do? Rarely seen together in this pose. Outbreak of fleas, lice, or brainlessness in Washington. Where's my brain? Lots of stuff we can do personally. And I'll come back to this at the end, so I'll skip over that one quickly. I personally am carbon neutral. I neutralize all my emissions through the Solar Electric Light Fund, which puts solar PV in villages instead of using kerosene. And we can all neutralize our personal lives. Every business should become carbon neutral. In Britain, I should say, the entire government has announced that 100% of government operations will be carbon neutral by the year 2012. That's $300 billion annual budget, all to be carbon neutral, which means that they're going to be investing. Every time they pay money to neutralize themselves, that money goes into technologies which drive down carbon emissions. We need will, vision, determination. This is why we set up the BC Sustainable Energy Association, to mobilize the power of citizens to organize this stuff. Sorry, should have changed that to what can we do here. We need to be Vancouver. Whoops, there. We should be a champion for this region. We need to set clear goals. I'll move over that very quickly. This is a village in Somerset, a small community of 1,100 people. In that small community, they've got four action groups on recycling, changing their travel needs, reducing their energy needs. They've got a 16-page food guide to show how you can get food produced within 15 kilometers, very similar to what Spud is doing here, the brown box delivery system. They've got a new people signed up for their veggie box system. They've got local energy companies donating light bulbs. They've got studying their homes intensively to reduce their emissions. They've got a community newsletter on reducing energy. Community talks on solar hot water. They've got 80% of the city village recycling, four times the British national average. They're converting their cars to biodiesel. They've got a carbon offset fund within the village so that when they go traveling, they can offset their travel emissions. That's what one tiny village could do. This is the size of five streets. Think about it. If every group of 5 or 10 streets got together and did this stuff, what a turnaround we could achieve. There's lots happening already. California's committed to a 25% reduction in emissions by 2020, 80% by 2050. 250 U.S. cities have pledged to meet Kyoto. Yesterday, 22 Canadian cities pledged to meet the same standard and called on Harper to call to meet Kyoto. There's a lot happening. Our Sustainable Energy Association has now got well over 500 members, over 60 businesses. We've got so many initiatives I couldn't list them. It's all based on volunteer skill and activity. We've got a very active chapter in Vancouver. We've got a table at the back where you can pick up a membership form. It's only $10 for low income, $35 regular. But please do, we've got a temporary problem with our electronic sign-up, so pick up a membership form and send us a cash or check. We want your membership because we've got to change the world. We need to do this stuff. Never doubt that a small group of people like us can change the world. It's the only thing that ever has. This is how we stopped slavery. This is how we got women the vote. This is how we stop working people doing an 80-hour week. This is how we stop children working down the coal mines, by organizing, by remembering the passion of being human, our love for life, our love for who we are, our love for this planet, and not giving in and surrendering to the past. There are only two problems we face on this planet. The first is the sum total of all our social, environmental, etc. problems. The second is the belief that we cannot solve them. If we believe we can't solve these problems, we are part of the problem. The reason why Easter Island went down, they were so isolated from the rest of the world, they thought they were the only people left. They couldn't get their boats out in a westerly direction where they come from. They thought they were totally isolated. Okay, hands up, how many of you have email? Hands up now. Every one of you is connected to the entire global brain. Every paper that anyone's produced is available to you within 4 seconds. Don't tell me we haven't got a reason, we haven't got the knowledge base for doing this. We can do this thing. We can, you know, the world's energy needs could be achieved by solar thousands of times over. Solar alone, let alone all the other energy systems. So here's the book I put together that spells out all the solutions for individuals, for cities, for schools, for colleges, for businesses, right up to the global level. And I put this poster together as well. It's at the back, and I like to get this into the... This should be in the washroom of every mayor, every CEO, every premier, every college principal, every school teacher, so when they're sitting on the can, they can stare at it and sort of, you know, learn how to stop this thing and get excited about the solutions. Our choice is this. We either sit back and wait for our civilization to fall apart, as happened on Easter Island, or we simply get to work and build the kind of world we want. If we're not guided by a conscious vision of the future we want to see, we will be guided by our unconscious acceptance of the present we already have. And that present we already have is typified by Richard Neufeld giving approval for BC Hydro to go ahead and do 2 coal-fired power plants in BC that's coming up. Unless we stop them, BC Hydro is planning to burn coal. It is shameful to live in a province that is planning to burn coal to boost energy. It's shameful to live in a province that has no goals, no coherent plan to reduce greenhouse gas emissions at all. It's shameful to live in a province that wants to expand freeways and twin the Portman Bridge. And it's fantastic that the GVRD voted against that proposal this week. And came out and said, yes, we've got to stop that proposal. And it's also fantastic that you have a thing here like One Day Vancouver, when you can go to the website and see what you can do in your home, in your school, at work, and there's a list of all the actions you can take away. When you go away tonight, go to onedayvancouver.ca, and everyone can take part and be part of the solution. In quantum physics, there are particles whose origins lies in the past, and particles whose origins lies in the future. Electrons and positrons. Every habit we do as humans is premised on a past action, but every choice is premised on a future intention. When you plan to come here, you set your intention in the future and you acted towards it. It's the shape of our intentions that determines the future of our lives, and the shape of our intentions about the world that determines the future of the world. This is very fundamental philosophy and very fundamental quantum physics about how the universe works. We create the future by our intentions, not by our habits. Change our intentions and the whole world changes with us. Our consciousness, I'm going back to the Big Bang now, evolved from the Big Bang, the stardust. When we see, when we read poetry, when we have discussions, we are stardust thinking. We are part of a conscious universe. We are the universe itself pondering where do we go. The question is, how are we going to choose? That's the critical question. We've come a long way since evolution began. 14 billion years. Where are we going? That's our choice. We are the generation, not our children. We can't afford to hand this mess over to our children. We are the generation who have to take this responsibility and make this happen. If we allow global climate change to run its course, we are in effect giving up on the choice, the gift of choice that nature's given us. A gift of choice that I would argue was present from the time the very first atom fell in love with another atom and created a molecule. Nature's waiting for our decision. Lots of solutions. All we have to do is decide. It's our willpower that's the critical thing. Our world's full of grief and sorrow and defeat, people longing for love, people feeling hopeless. Our choice is to fill the world with love and hope and vision and healing. Because this is almost our, I believe, our spiritual destiny, to move towards the deepest part of our hearts and build a world based on love and build on hope. Put aside our differences. Come together. Build our future. We have work to do. And because the children very rarely get a voice, I'm finishing on this image from an 8-year-old in Indonesia. She hasn't got a vote yet. But that's her vision. Together forever, save the earth. Thank you.
You've been listening to a speech by Guy Donsey, the author of Stormy Weather, 101 Solutions to Global Climate Change, with a foreword by Ross Gelbspan. To find out more about the book, contact earthfuture.com. This recording was kindly made available by Thomas Hicks of Necessary Voices. Thank you, Thomas.